Hello. This is the Angry GM, and this is Q and Angry, the follow-up podcast. And today, I am following up my feature, What Makes a Challenge, a part of my ongoing True Scenario Designery course. And I am actually in the Angry Game Studio here alone, not for lack of trying. It just appears that nobody else was available to hang out. So I have no one to bounce things off of, but that's okay because I have a script and I have already gathered up questions, many of which I am just going to outright refuse to answer. And so here we go. As I alluded to in the proofread aloud and also through several messages on various platforms, this article, What Makes a Challenge, which was the third in my three-part series of basic introductory game design crap that we would build on throughout the True Scenario Designery course, this article was a beast of an article. It took me many extra days. I think three or four extra days of work went into this article. The first draft was something like 8,500 words, which is too long for a draft, but it was also not the sort of thing that I could split up into two parts easily because it would have demanded a really heavy front-loaded first part and then basically a vague, fluffy clean up and random ideas sort of second part. I couldn't find a way to divvy it up, so it had to go into rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, and each time it got shorter and shorter and shorter. Because it has now left me in the position of being so far behind, as it is now the last week of August and I still have three articles to finish and publish, this episode of Q and Angry is the last one I'm recording in August. After this, it's going on hiatus. I will still do the proofread alouds because those are part of my proofreading process. But if you are a fan of Q and Angry, there will be a little lull. And then in September, I will start offering these again. I may even go back and backfill one or two articles that I think deserve Q and Angry follow-ups. But frankly, they probably won't, and we can get by without them. So just be warned about that. One of the things that made this article so challenging is that it's just sort of a survey of basic concepts, and I am not good at keeping that in mind. Everything I discussed in this article, I will go over again and again and again and again, deeper and longer and harder, and I really should have thought a little longer before I started that sentence, but so be it, because I'm one take angry and I don't go back and edit anything out except when I do, which I do sometimes, but not now. Anywho, this is a basic concepts article. I was just trying to introduce some basic ideas, and I kept drilling down and overanalyzing them and presenting more and more and more and more and more and more different situations. When you get down to it, the concept of challenge design, the art of challenge design, and this is where there's going to be a struggle for everybody, and we're going to see it in the questions today. The art of challenge design is really what scenario design is all about, especially when we start getting into the concept of micro challenges and macro challenges. Okay, so this whole course, the whole True Scenario Designery thing, when you get down to it, is just about making challenges and stringing them together. So trying to condense that down into one 5,000-word article to just put some basic concepts so that we can start actually doing some practical work with it, when there's enough material that I think I can fill a year of coursework, I keep calling it coursework, like we all know it's just a blog, right? I'm just a blogger. But when I can get a year of blogging material out of this topic and I have to basically drill it down to what absolutely do you need to know so that you're not too stupid to even look at the very basics, well, that's a really hard thing to drill down. And that's why the article took so long and got so late. And I'm not going to go into anything more about everything else that's been going on this month. I'm just explaining why this one article was a beast, especially when if you read it, it doesn't seem that difficult. It doesn't seem like there's anything untoward about it. It's probably hard to even see what might have been cut from it, because a hell of a lot was cut. And someone even asked me to go over the stuff that was cut when I was doing the proofread aloud. And I'm like, no, it's going to come back. Like, everything that was cut, if it's important, it's coming back. And if it's not important, it was a good cut. And so I'm not going to show you the crap that I cut that I ultimately decided was worthless crap that deserved to be cut, because, you know, I'm actually good at this. Anywho, I have nothing really to clarify about the article, because anything that I might want to clarify and expand on will turn into an hour or two discussion as I get way too deep into things that I was just trying to conceptually introduce. I am very happy just introducing the basic idea of challenge and trying to get you folks to think about it in a different way and to stop quantifying the hell out of it as some sort of numerical difficulty measure, and to stop mistaking mechanical in-game terms for anything to do with the concept of challenge as a game design thing. Which brings me to the first question from Woosh, who wanted to know if, as I said in the article, you cannot really use the game's descriptions of encounters, combat encounters specifically, as easy, medium, hard, deadly, or whatever. If you can't use those things as a description of the actual difficulty, capital D difficulty, of a challenge, how can you talk about the difficulty of a combat encounter? The first thing to understand is why I said that. And the reason I said that is because the way difficulty, little d difficult, or difficulty rating of an encounter, I'm going to say challenge rating, even though they use different games use different terms. I'm just going to use the broad term challenge rating to describe where the game says, here's how you design a challenge, and when you're done, this should be easy, and this should be medium, and this will kill people. We're just going to call that all challenge rating, just to simplify the discussion. The way tabletop role-playing games that bother with this challenge shit, like D&D and Pathfinder, and mostly they're the only ones except for the things that are basically ripoffs of D&D, like 13th Age has a similar system. But anyway, the way they calculate what they're calling challenge rating, encounter difficulty, yada, 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 is as a basic mathematical expected value based on averages. That is, if you take a group of X characters and put them in an encounter with this monster, then we expect that each character will hit X number of times and get this many attacks, and the monster will attack this many times and get this many, do this much damage, and this is the expected value of the damage, and based on the hit point levels of characters at that level and monsters of that level, this is how much damage we expect everybody to take when the thing is all over, which means when the fight is over and the monsters are dead, this is how many resources the player characters will have expended. That is what they're calling their challenge rating. That is a mathematical expected value. It's based on like a simulation. Like if you just imagine the characters and the monsters rolling dice back and forth at each other, that is the outcome you expect. That's why it has nothing to do with difficulty. It's just a probability, which is what I defined in the article. And that's why you can't use it to talk about how hard a combat encounter is. In the dirty real world, is there a correlation between the actual difficulty, the degree to which the players are stressed trying to overcome the challenge, and the game's mathematical expected value probability challenge rating? Yes, of course there is. All else being equal, a monster that chews up more of the party's resources, if the party wants to come through it with as much of their resources intact as possible, will tax them more than a monster that chews up fewer of their resources. So the more clever plans and cunning capers the party pulls off during the combat, and the better they synergize their abilities and pick the right abilities for the right situation and move the right ways and mitigate damage and all that shit that they can do during combat because it's open-ended, the better off they'll be on average. So yes, there is a correlation. But importantly, It's not a quantifiable thing. There is no such thing as easy difficulty combat encounter. There's an expected value probability thing for what that means in terms of the character's resources that they'll use up. But when we're doing scenario design, we can't speak quantitatively about difficulty. And difficulty is a big, vague, open space anyway. Okay, so what you can talk about is, you know, the baseline, the game has a baseline difficulty. And that's based on basically the players and the monsters just trade dice back and forth and don't think too hard. They just use their abilities pretty much as written. Okay? That's the baseline difficulty. And D&D assumes that if mindless monsters and mindless players go at it, the players will win, and they will use X number of resources depending on the encounter balance of the encounter. Okay? That's the baseline. If you want to adjust the difficulty so that you challenge the players more or less because you find that the baseline is too much for them, you can do it. Is there a numerical, mathematical, simulational way you can talk about that? Absolutely friggin' not. There isn't. Okay? Instead, you can just say, well, I can make this challenge a little harder if I expand the battlefield so that the monsters and the players need an extra round to get to each other. Or I can make it a little easier if the players have ranged attacks and the monsters do not. Things like that. And that's all very fuzzy, and that's the only way we can really talk about challenge difficulty in role-playing games. That's the only way we can talk about it in anything. It's an art, it's not a science, and it's not a math. Continuing the theme of trying to make this a math, Athetos from Axiom Verge asks, how do you design specific challenges for specific constraints? And then Athetos provided me a list of three different scenarios and wanted to know how I would change the challenge design process for those scenarios. This is a stupid question. No offense to Athetos, except I guess it's an offense. See, I didn't call Athetos stupid. I just said the question was stupid. Smart people ask stupid questions, too. Athetos is probably very smart. As I understand it from Axiom Verge, he was a scientific super genius megalomaniac. But it is a stupid question nonetheless, because I haven't even talked about how to design a challenge for non-constrained situations. So how am I supposed to say, here's how you would adjust a thing I haven't explained to do different things? But the key is, and now I'm going to give a very vague answer because I, you know, if I cite a question in here, I'm going to answer it. It just might not be the answer that the person wants because they asked me a stupid question. First of all, if you have a constraint like, oh, I have to design this scenario to fit in 3 hours because that's I'm running it at a convention and that's all I've got, well, obviously you have to identify your constraints and then design challenges that fit in those constraints. That's the answer. Okay, so obviously if you're sitting there designing a scenario for a convention, you do not put in a combat that, based on your experience and knowledge with the system, will take an hour to resolve. That's bad design. You will instead design an encounter that, based on your knowledge and experience of the system, is easily resolved in a half hour or 20 minutes, whatever time frame you want to set to it. Okay, the same is true for any constraints you might imagine. And this shows the key, or two of the key features of scenario design. Number one, it is creative, artistic design. You have to figure out what you're going to design, then design it. And there's no process. This is invention. This is creation. It's not a step-by-step thing where you could just say, well, then you adjust the difficulty of the encounters. You can't do that. You have to identify your constraints and then look at what you're doing and say, this ain't going to work, or I need something like this. Okay? Which means the second thing is, you have to know the system you're working with intimately before you start doing scenario design. Scenario design is not something you just do blind. I don't write homebrew adventures for any system that I have not played for at least 3 months using other people's written materials first. That is why I always start learning a system by using its starter box, starter set. And then if the starter set does not give me enough of an experience that I feel like I can effectively design scenarios for the system, I will then run published adventures until I feel ready to design for the system. But you have to know your system inside out, frontwards, and back. Which is why when people are talking to me and asking for me advice in the Discord about how to design an adventure, and then I point out that something exists in the Game Master's Guide, and they're like, I didn't know that was there. I'm like, then you are not ready to design scenarios at all. You should not be doing this yet. You should at least know what's in the three core rule books for your system. Okay. I do want to address very briefly two specific constrained situations Athatos, the villain from Axiom Verge, brought up. Number one, how do you design for people, for other GMs to run the adventure? And number two, how do you design for you to run adventures for your group at home that you know very well? Is there a difference? And yes, obviously there is a difference. If you are designing a scenario for someone who isn't you to run, regardless of who they're running it for, you have to spell everything out in a lot of detail. Whereas if you're designing a scenario you're just going to run yourself, you can leave a lot of stuff unwritten or even unsaid, and because you know your own skills at the table and what you can handle, you can leave holes in your design. I don't recommend this, but we all do it anyway. You can leave holes in your design you know you're perfectly capable of dealing with at the table. I mean, my scenario design for my own gameplay is usually scribbled notes on the back of 10 different cocktail napkins, and maybe some page references to stat blocks in the book. That's what I do. I don't even draw maps in advance a lot of the time, unless it's like an extensive dungeon complex. I will just pull maps out of my butt. Okay. Mendel wants to know what's wrong with the break down the door option that I said demonstrates the complete failing of modern tabletop role-playing games. Because in the article I did say, I would love to write an entire article in which I explain why we break down the door is a terrible action that shows everything that went wrong in tabletop role-playing games in the last 20 years. Okay? To answer your question, Mendel, how is this a whole article? I have basically 3 to 5, I'm looking at the time now, I have basically 3 minutes to squeeze this answer in. And that is sure as hell not enough time for me to analyze where all of tabletop role-playing went wrong. But I just want you to consider one thing. Okay. First of all, ignore the modern conception of an interior door that is made out of like popsicle sticks and hollow balsa wood that we use to separate our bedroom from our hallway in our house, and that basically I could take down with a stiff wind. Okay? And consider actually a door made of solid oak planks lacquered against the elements and then banded in iron that has somehow withstood the ravages of time and now sits in a dungeon. And somebody says to me, I will break down the door. That is their whole action. How are they doing this? Are they chewing through it? Are they punching it? Are they kicking it? How the hell is a barehanded human being demolishing that? Like, there's no description, there's no instruction, there's no possible way in my head I, as a game master, can actually conceive that action. I cannot picture a human being walking up to a door like that, an actual door, and just somehow destroying it, demolishing it. Okay? It doesn't make sense. Okay? Back in the day, in the AD&D days, we didn't have break down the door. Okay? It's important. Like, this is why it needs a whole article. No, you know what? It needs a whole article past that. I have made my point. The point that players just think they can say, I break down the door. Clatter. My strength check is a 20. It's like, I would like to know more about how you're accomplishing this amazing feat. What you're doing to your... Oh, you're going to break it down with your rapier, huh? Yeah, can you explain to me that one, too? So anyway, that's my rant. Father Fan wanted to know how scenario designers are to decide between using meaningless and meaningful challenges. Because in the article, I pointed out that there are meaningless challenges. They technically fit the definition of a challenge, but at the same time, they don't require any serious skill or thought or effort on the part of the players. It's sort of a simple thing like, you know, choose left or right or pick the lock or break down the door, whatever it is, right? And those are fairly meaningless challenges. But I then pointed out those have their place in adventure design and you should not stop using them just because they're meaningless. There's nothing wrong with meaningless challenges and you need a sprinkling of meaningless challenges. Every challenge should not be meaningful and hefty. Sometimes you can just have a locked door or sometimes you can just have the quicksand that is like swim across or go around. Whatever it is, you can do that. So how do you decide when to do when or when to do the other? Well, this goes back to what I said earlier, and that is, it's the art of design, okay? Just like how do you decide whether the next room should have a combat or a social encounter or whether there should be a trap here or whatever? That's the art of it. That's what you have to decide on a case-by-case basis as you're building adventures. The only reason I included that comment was because I have dumbass elitists, who I've been dealing with, by the way, for weeks since I started talking about locked doors. I have dumbass elitists in my fan base who think they're too good to just have a simple locked door or a pick left or right challenge. And I needed to point out that no, you're not. Those are perfectly fine. They're valid. They have their place. They're sort of like... You know, they sort of ease off the pacing, okay? It's like, here, this is a low-pressure one now. Guys, you know, you spent an hour on that moral dilemma, and everybody feels depressed. So now how about, do you want to roll a pick check or do you want to roll a break check? Okay. Father Fan also wanted to know, and further inviting my ire, what other encounter types pair with what other ways of making meaningful encounters? Because I offered a brief survey of some examples of ways that you can add more meaning to a challenge by making things incomparable, by adding costs and consequences, stuff like that. And I ended that by saying there is no way that you can come up with a clean clinical list and match things up easily. It's easy to do it in a classroom where I'm just writing this shit, but when you actually sit down and do it, none of it breaks down that way. So don't ask me to just list this shit and rattle it off. So Father Fan, who apparently considers reading a high difficulty challenge, immediately asked me to rattle off a list and pair them off with challenge types, as if that means anything. That's because I made the mistake of saying, often puzzles and mysteries rely on obfuscation rather than any of the other kinds of meaningful challenges. I made the mistake of calling out one specific situation where there was a tendency of certain kinds of scenarios to use certain kinds of challenge over others, and now it's like, well, give me the whole damn list of all of them. Yeah, no, I can't do that. I did do another one, by the way. There was moral dilemmas. Dilemmas, often moral dilemmas, right? Social, see, now I'm going to do it. Social situations often cost consequence or dilemma. Those are the two ones that come up in social situations a lot. And it's usually consequences, not costs. Because all social situations carry with them an inherent consequence. That is, you're dealing with a living, breathing, quote, game construct that has a memory. So however you interact with that person, number one, they're going to remember, and number two, they're going to tell others. So that is an easy way to build consequences into the game world when the players choose to lie and get caught in it, or when they choose to intimidate, or when they choose to seduce someone, and then later, because I love this one, like the seduction check, and then later, you know, you get what you wanted, and then you never see the person. You don't think that person's going to be pissed? Seduction is horrible. So anyway, so yes, social situations often include consequences and dilemmas. There, I did one, now get off my back. So that I can finish with Artful Dodger, who asks, when does a string of challenges become a micro-challenge? Because although I mentioned briefly in the article that I wasn't going to talk about macro-challenges, I think I might have said that wrong. But when does a string of challenges become a macro challenge? I might have misspoke. The question is, when does a string of challenges become a macro challenge? A macro challenge, of course, being a protracted challenge that the players don't confront directly, but which arises from a number of different gameplay dynamics. I gave the example of a boss fight where, you know, like the boss fight comes after the end of a bunch of fights. And so in addition to each fight providing its own micro challenge, its own isolated challenge, the boss fight has an extra dimension of challenge because if you did not get through the individual fights that preceded it with enough resources, enough hit points, enough spells, enough charges in your wands, whatever it is, healing potion, doesn't matter. If you didn't get through all those fights with enough of whatever, the boss fight may be prohibitively difficult or impossible to win. So that's an example of a macro challenge. That is a challenge that grows out of a whole gameplay dynamic rather than one single obstacle that you just, you know, throw in front of the players. Another example, by the way, is winning a game of Magic the Gathering. Magic the Gathering, the entire game, you know, reducing your enemy to 20 hit points or emptying their entire library or reducing the enemy to 0 hit points from 20 or emptying their library or, you know, using some card combo that says, and then I win. Those are the ways you win. The way you have to actually get there involves a whole series of little individual actions. How do you manage your mana? What creatures do you summon? How do you respond to what the enemy does to you? How do you, you know, the enemy is attacking with this turn, you know, how do you protect yourself without using so many resources that it ruins your ability to win 3 turns down the road? That's a macro challenge. I almost tried to misspeak again. That's a macro challenge. So when does a string of micro challenges become a macro challenge? Never. That is not something that automatically happens. That is something you have to intentionally create in the design. Okay? It's not just if I put enough encounters together, it's a macro challenge. Now, caveat to this is that Dungeons and Dragons and most tabletop role-playing games, even the ones that don't work like Dungeons and Dragons, are built so that if you create adventures, scenarios for them, you are creating macro challenges even without knowing it. For example, the fact that D&D has combat encounters that use up your resources and your resources don't come back instantaneously, and the fact that you were expected to get through a certain number of encounters in an adventure, which is why game masters are told to write adventures that way, all of that is designed to produce a resource management macro challenge where you can win all of the fights but still lose the adventure if you've chewed up so many resources that some final challenge is just beyond you. Okay, which is also why if you don't follow the instructions that the system designers give you, you may be ruining your games without realizing it because they sneakily build this shit in so that any random average dumbass who picks up their rulebook can make an adventure that works not just as a gauntlet of random obstacles, but actually as a complete cohesive whole. So they don't become macro challenges automatically unless the system designers were smart enough to sneak that in there, which in the case of D&D and combat encounters and adventuring days, they were. And that is the end of this Q and Angry. And as I said, I will not be doing another Q and Angry for a couple of weeks. They will resume in September. I am sorry about that. I just have to focus on getting caught up because this article was a monster.